Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the University of Southern Maine Issues and Promising Strategies Recruitment and Retention Part 1 conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions on how to participate will be given at that time. If anyone requires operator assistance during today's call, please press star, then zero on your telephone. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Ms. Mary O'Brien.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. This is Mary O'Brien, and I'm pleased to welcome everyone to today's call on Issues and Promising Strategies, Recruitment and Retention. We apologize for the delay in getting started. I am here representing the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. Today's session is the first in a series of three teleconferences that we have planned as part of a series on recruitment and retention of a qualified workforce. We are pleased to be able to use this series to highlight the work of the sites funded by the Federal Children's Bureau to provide models of effective child welfare staff recruitment and retention. We have three speakers for today's session. Frieda Bernatovich, who's a senior research associate at the Muskie School of Public Service at the University of Southern Maine, will be speaking first to give us an overview of the issues, and she'll be moderating today's call. Then we'll hear from Catherine Potter, who's director of the Butler Institute at the University of Denver, who will give an overview of the strategies the sites have used. And from Mary Berg, who's child welfare director at the Jefferson County Department of Human Services in Colorado, who will give us an administrator's perspective. I just want to go over a couple of logistics before we begin. We've had a lot of interest in today's call, registration from representatives from over 30 different state child welfare agencies, in addition to lots of providers and university partners. In addition, we have registration from most of our ACF regional offices as well as a number of national organizations. So we expect to have up to 60 or 70 lines calling in. So because of that, we're going to keep the phone lines closed, as the operator said, and we'll open them a couple of different times for questions and discussion. And the operator will give you instructions at that point. The handouts for today's call are posted on our website. Frieda Bernatovich and Catherine Potter will be working off of one of the PowerPoints on that website, which is called Recruitment and Retention of a Qualified Workforce. And Mary Berg will be talking from another, which is called The View from the Agency's Perspective. These PowerPoint presentations are found at our website, which is www.nrcoi.org. That stands for the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. So it's www.nrcoi.org. You'll also find at that website the links to all of the other grantee sites and a link to a part of our website that has other links and resources on workforce issues. If you go to that website, you can click on teleconferences on the left and then go to the date of the call for those handouts. So with that background, we're going to get started. Thanks for everyone for your patience, and I'm going to turn it over to Frieda to begin.
Thanks, Mary, and welcome everybody. I'm going to do a brief overview of some of the issues. And by now, I think we've all heard of the demographic crisis going on in the workforce because there are articles in the popular press as well as in professional journals. And this crisis is being caused by a combination of factors: upcoming retirement of the baby boom generation and the fact that there are fewer young people entering the workforce. And this crisis, like the Chinese symbol for danger, presents both a challenge and an opportunity for us. The challenge is the frightening reality of the statistics, which I'll talk about in a little more detail later, and the fact that it's unavoidable. The opportunity comes from the fact that the crisis is bringing attention to a critical issue in child welfare that's plagued the field for at least 40 years. We now can't continue business as usual, the revolving door of people entering and leaving the organization. In the past, we could always depend on there being someone else to enter the door, but that's no longer true. And this issue is also getting attention because studies are showing the high cost of turnover. So we can no longer afford to take the sort of piecemeal approach that we tended to take in the past to workforce, because we've got increasing evidence of its high cost. And so this is challenging us to be more strategic and to focus on approaches that work. And in this series, we'll be presenting examples of some of these promising approaches. And let's start with looking at the first slide presentation, the human cost of turnover. And that's in terms of the impact on children and families. And we find that turnover gets to the very heart of the child welfare work, the relationship between caseworkers and clients. There have been a number of qualitative studies that have been done that have shown that when a worker leaves, children often feel that it's because of them, of something they've done or failed to do. Constant turnover also means that the sense of trust is undermined and it's harder for the next worker to develop a good relationship. What I'm going to do in this overview is to provide some information on four issues: the impact of the demographics on the workforce, the impact on the organization, the direct financial impact, and the impact on outcomes. In terms of demographics, as I said, the forces impacting the entire workforce in this country, and in fact, internationally, are so strong that in the human resource management literature, people are talking about a perfect storm or a coming tsunami. They're using all these sort of meteorological metaphors to talk about the force of the impact that this is going to have. And the aging of the baby boom generation and the fact that fewer young people are available to enter the workforce means by the year of 2012, which is only 4 years from now, there are going to be 3 million more jobs than workers in the economy. And this is going to impact every sector in the economy, healthcare, education, manufacturing, as well as human services. So child welfare agencies are going to be competing with every other sector for a shrinking labor pool. Unfortunately, as a field, we're at a disadvantage, and this demographic tsunami is going to hit social services harder than other sectors. And there are a number of reasons for this, one of which is that the need for workers in social services is growing at a faster pace than in other sectors. Another is that the workforce in social services is aging disproportionately. And the new workers who are coming in, they're being called the millennial workers, the next generation after the Generation X. They have different values about work, and they don't have the same sense of organizational loyalty and are looking for more of a balance between their work life and their personal life. So given these strategic advantages that we're going to be facing in the future, how are we doing to prepare ourselves for this competitive market in terms of salaries, vacancy rates, and turnover? The data that I have in the next few slides are based on national surveys by the American Public Human Services Association, APHSA, and we don't have comparable data on private agencies where often turnover is much higher. So let's look first at salaries. To attract and keep good workers in a tight labor market, we need to offer salaries that are competitive with similar positions and which are equitable in terms of the demands of the work. Unfortunately, the trends are not positive, and the data from the 2000 survey, followed up by the survey in 2004, showed that we are not competitive, that the average salaries are lower for comparable positions. The average salary nationally for child welfare caseworkers is about $36,000, which is lower than for nurses, teachers, and policemen. And also, the salaries have not kept up with the cost of living. In terms of vacancies, we find that the vacancy rate has an impact on turnover because the remaining workers and supervisors have up the workload of vacant positions. Again, this data is not encouraging because positions are staying open longer, about twice as long, in fact, in 2004, 7 to 13 weeks compared to 2000, where it was 6 to 7 weeks. The vacancy rate for child welfare workers is 6 times higher than for other government workers, at 9% rather than 1.5%. And the turnover rate increased slightly from 2000 to 2004 to about 20% compared to 9.6% for state and local government workers. The good news was that the preventable turnover rate remained fairly stable at around 12%. If we think about the impact on the organization, we realize that turnover has an interactive effect on the whole agency. When a caseworker leaves, the vacancy creates additional work for already overloaded staff and results in increased stress and decreased morale for those who stay. Because of this, there's also an impact on the relationship. The cases become more difficult and forming relationships harder, leading to a reduced sense of self-efficacy for the caseworker. New hires need time to get up to speed, and agency resources need to go into training them, putting the agency in a constant maintenance mode of orienting and training new workers rather than providing the specialized training and professional development needed to retain experienced workers. And then there's the financial cost of turnover. It has a direct financial impact on the organization. In the human resource management literature, there are formulas for the cost of turnover that range from 50 to 200% of the salary of that position. So if we took an average salary for a caseworker being around $36,000, the cost of turnover would be between $18,000 and $72,000 per worker. And in Maine, a couple of years ago, we did a detailed study looking at all of the costs associated with turnover and came up with a figure of $16,273 per worker. In New York State, they did a study and found that the training costs alone in one upstate rural county came to about $24,000 per worker. So let's think about what this means to a specific agency with different levels of turnover. So the next little graph suggests that there's a hypothetical agency with a staff of 200 and a conservative estimate of turnover per worker at $20,000. And the graph shows how rapidly costs can accelerate. At 20%, which is the average rate of turnover, the annual direct cost to that agency would be about $800,000. And you can see how quickly they go up as the turnover rate goes above that level. And these are resources that could go to fund other priorities in the agency. So now let's look at the impact on outcomes. A study in 2003 by the Government Accountability Office found that workforce deficiencies and high turnover were having an impact on child welfare outcomes. And these findings have been reinforced by research findings in the last few years. First, let's look at the outcome of safety. A study was done of services in 12 California counties. Data was used to classify them as high, moderate, and low functioning. The highest functioning had the lowest turnover and the lowest rates of recurrence of abuse and neglect. The lowest functioning had the highest turnover and the highest rate of recurrence of abuse and neglect. In terms of permanency, the striking data that comes from a study of child welfare in Milwaukee, where the turnover rate was very high. It was between 34% to 67% in a 9-month period in 2004. As a result, over 40% of the families and 40% of the children had more than one worker in this period of time. And the data, which you see on the next bar graph, showed a direct relationship between the turnover and permanency. Children entering care with only one worker achieved permanency in 74.5% of the cases. That's the bar in the bottom bar in the bar graph. And you see that pale blue bar is way up there at 74%. As the number of case managers increased, the percentage of children achieving permanency dropped substantially, ranging from 17.5% of those who had two case managers to a low of 0.1%, virtually none, when the children had six or seven case managers. And that's some of the most dramatic data that I've seen that shows the direct relationship between turnover and outcomes. But in another study in Illinois, the authors found that turnover caused fewer services to children and their families. The data also showed that foster children and foster parents were contacted less often, and that caseworker changes resulted in fewer visits with families of origin. Another study in Illinois found that caseworker turnover is related to length of stay. Children with multiple caseworkers experience significantly longer stays in foster care, and turnover also decreases the likelihood of achieving family reunification. The good news is that with this data and with this increased attention to workforce, workforce issues are getting in the performance improvement plans in the state. And there are, states are addressing the issues using a variety of strategies, starting in many cases with acknowledging the fact that workforce issues are important and need to have attention paid to them. Agencies are also talking about efforts to improve their caseload and workload, about efforts around staff recruitment and retention, supporting supervisors and providing supervisory training, worker training, and staff education, certification, and licensing. And what we're going to be doing in this teleconference series, as Mary said, is highlighting some promising strategies for recruitment, selection, and retention using examples from the Child Welfare Recruitment and Retention Grantees. And Kathy's going to be talking more specifically about some of those in the next part of this presentation. Kathy?
Thanks, Frieda. So, Mary O'Brien, am I on and good?
Yes, sounds great. Yep.
Great. Thank you so much. Hello, everybody. I have just a little bit of a frog in my throat, so I'm going to apologize in advance. My job today is to talk a bit about some of the promising strategies for recruitment, selection, and retention, and to highlight a few things that have come from the 8 recruitment and retention grantees. You have a slide that shows where the universities are that had those recruitment and retention grants. And there's also a handout posted that has a little summary of the work of each of the grantees and has information on it about how to contact them. And we'd like to say up front as grantees that we're always interested in talking with people who continue to be interested in workload issues. So if you have questions or you'd like some more information, feel free to come to our websites or give us a call. Let me talk just briefly about the characteristics of the recruitment and retention projects. 8 of us were funded, and we all wrote very different proposals, but there were some common attributes that became more common as we worked together as a partnership and a team over time. All of the projects were data-driven. That is, all of the partnerships between a university and a local site, a local agency, were structured around information about the agency's situation. Several of our projects used organizational assessments. We all used human resources data of some kind. Many used surveys and focus groups with workers, supervisors, and managers. Some sites used exit interviews with workers who were leaving, et cetera. All of our projects were very strong university agency partnerships, and I'll talk a little bit later about some of the real positives of that. All of our projects had training components to them, but they really were focused on building organizational capacity related to the child welfare workforce. This is the next slide is entitled, Why Do They Stay? And this is the one I laugh about. This is the attempt to sum up in one slide a whole lot of research on retention in public child welfare. There are several important individual characteristics that cut across the many studies that have looked at this question. People stay if they're able to avoid burnout. And there are a number of personal characteristics that help people do that, that have to do with their motivation, their resiliency, their sense of self-efficacy, et cetera. It's important for workers that there's a goodness of fit between them and the work. That includes their comfort with the kind of work that they're doing, and it also includes some of the fit between themselves and the way they interact with the organization. Professional and organizational commitment among workers is a predictor of staying. Almost all studies that look at this question really highlight the importance of supervision on worker retention. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but supervision seems to be a real critical linchpin to keeping workers with the agency. And then at the organizational level, we have two categories of things that help us understand why people stay. We have organizational practices that have to do with how we do business and how the policies and other kinds of structural supports that are there for the workforce. And then we have organizational climate that has to do with how people experience the work, how they're treated at work, the quality of the leadership that's in their agency, the support and competence of their supervisor, et cetera. Just wanted to give you a couple of upcoming publications, either out or upcoming publications that come from the R&R grantees that are really good summaries of this, this literature on recruitment and retention. So let's focus in on recruitment, finding the best people, getting the best people in the door to apply for your jobs. Our experience and the literature would tell us that there are several important things we need to pay attention to in the recruitment phase. One is that people have a realistic understanding of the job. As a person who teaches in a social work program, I'm constantly amazed when we interview for our stipend program, how many people have no clue what the job is that they're applying to commit to. We want to help people really understand the job before and during the process of bringing them in the door. There is also some indication that inside source recruiting, that is, people who work for you, who help recruit people that they know that would they think would be a good fit with the job, is an important piece of the recruiting mechanism that you might build. Again, in the recruitment phase, we want to pay some attention between the fit between the applicant and the work that we are recruiting them to do. And we want to pay some attention to recruiting folks with some of the characteristics that make for good caseworkers and that also make for caseworkers who stay. A high sense of human caring, motivation to make a difference, their persistence, multitasking, the ability to work in challenging and fast-paced situations. One of our grantees, the Jordan Institute at the University of North Carolina, really focused in on some recruitment things. And the next few slides give you a little bit of a picture of some of the things that they developed. It's important to develop a recruiting message and a plan. Professional-looking materials, posters, flyers, public service announcements, really having the word out in the community that this is a good place to work. Are important, and it's important to use diverse methods to reach potential employees, especially younger potential employees who are not looking for work by reading the one ads in the newspaper anymore. It's important to involve supervisors because of that inside recruitment piece. The next slide gives you a sample advertisement developed by the Jordan Institute. Give everybody a chance to read it. I'm just going to read it out loud in case there are a few of you that don't have the handouts easily. The Child Welfare Agency, insert your agency here, is a fast-paced, supportive, and stimulating place to work. We're looking for child welfare workers who desire challenging, meaningful work and welcome the opportunity to make a difference for families and children. If this describes you, consider applying for a public child welfare position at... name of agency, you will never be bored. The next slide shows you a poster developed by the Jordan Institute. Again, I'll read what's on it, although if you don't have the picture with you, it you're not getting the full impact, but the verbiage is low pay, a ton of paperwork, a massive caseload, upset parents. Sure, sign me up. Public child welfare work, it's not for everyone. It's for people who believe they can make a difference in a world of challenges and hard knocks. You know who you are. Find a job that matters. We're next going to move into talking a little bit about selection processes. So we've done a good job of recruitment. We're bringing folks through the door. Then we need to have very solid processes for selecting people to join our organization. A good selection process is built on some strong HR processes. It's important to have a good good job analyses of positions so that you know exactly what the competencies are for the position and have some clarity about what you're hiring for and what you're training so that the total competencies that are required for the job are developed over a period of time after people enter into the job. So a good job analysis leads to some approaches to structured interviewing and work sample tests that let you give people a more let you use in your interview some questions and approaches and having them actually do some work that gives you greater insight into the person than just a pure question and answer. A good job analysis helps you develop well-trained selection teams. It's really important that they be consistent and well-trained. Very strong selection processes from an HR point of view are going to help us with consistency and with paying attention to the right things as we're selecting. HR is our friend. I've worked with a number of agencies where the people in HR and the people in child welfare aren't always sure about that. So that connection is one that's going to be very important moving forward. Realistic job previews are being used in many states. The realistic job preview is a video introduction to the job. It presents a balanced view of opportunities and challenges. It presents both client and worker perspectives. Several states have created these. Several of our grantees were involved in RJP creation. The Butler Institute that I work for created one in Arizona and is working on one that just was filmed in Colorado. The University of Michigan did one a bit earlier and did some research about workers who saw the realistic job preview versus or compared to workers who were hired without having seen it. And workers who saw the RJP were significantly more likely to indicate their commitment, to say that the application and selection process helped them cope with job pressures, and say that the agency's honesty made them feel more loyal. They were much less likely to endorse the statement that they never would have taken this job if they had known what it was like. So the realistic job preview is giving people an opportunity to have a window onto the job and then make some decisions about moving forward, and it may also be having some secondary influences on how people feel about the agency as they come in the door. The Arizona Realistic Job Preview it has the same video structure, but it's also supported by a trained group of current workers who are then on call to answer questions from applicants. Keeping the best. Now we have recruited them. We have selected them. We now have them working with us. What does it take to retain child welfare workers? I mentioned earlier that supervisors are the key to success. There are many influences in an agency, but supervisors are in particular very important. Almost every aspect of a worker's experience is mediated through their supervisor, especially early in the job. So the supervisor is the one who helps you make sense of what's going on. When it comes to working with clients, the supervisor is the one who helps you make sense of working on this team. And the supervisor also serves as a conduit and a buffer between the unit and the wider agency. All of our grantees focus to some degree on supervision. A number of good supervisor curricula were developed. I think in our the grantees that created specific supervisor curricula have that listed on the handout. It's all out there, developed by federal money. So if your state has an interest in looking at multiple supervisor curriculum, the grantees would be a good place to start. Let's see. We focus in a little bit here on the Iowa supervisor training, which was developed by Miriam Landsman's team in Iowa. That curriculum focuses specifically on human resource functions of the supervisor job, on supervising to case practice, and supervising to clinical supervision. And then the sort of workforce development piece that's highlighted there is the supervisor's role in leading positive change and promoting worker resilience. So how does the supervisor maximize their role in terms of retention of the workers that work for them? Organizational interventions are also really important in this arena. One of the things we learned very clearly as grantees was that organizational interventions can be productively facilitated by outside partners. Most child welfare agencies do not have a lot of extra time and resources to step back and take a look at their organizational practice and do some planning around that. having an outside partner who can do some of the facilitation, who can keep things moving between meetings, who can provide resources, go out there and figure out what other people are doing and then help bring that back to your team, was an important piece of all of our organizational work as grantees. One example of a training that sort of focused on this issue was Michigan State University's leadership curriculum for managers that included an intensive focus on recruitment and retention so that you prepared managers to manage to recruitment and retention. State University of New York at Albany had an extensive design team process. Local agency design teams focused on organizational culture and specific issues in the workplace. They were consisted of workers, supervisors, and managers, which were facilitated by SUNY Albany facilitators. The design team used data from the agency and organizational assessments, identified priority issues, and designed and implemented specific solutions in specific agencies. Some of the county managers or directors in New York have had some conversation with us about some of their, the trepidation they felt about having a design team begin to work, and a little bit worried about what would they come up with, what would they say we needed to do, sense that maybe that design team could spin out of control somehow. And then just being so gratified and excited about the way that the design teams really focused on the good of the agency, how they came up with these really creative and positive and supportive things that really did make a difference for culture in the agencies. Connecticut's mentoring program, which was facilitated by their partnership with Fordham University, focused on creating mentors for supervisors. So managers and administrators served as mentors. So far they've had a couple of hundred staff involved in this process, very high levels of management support in the agency. The goal is to provide opportunities for career development for supervisors and retention to really increase their leadership capacity, to give supervisors an opportunity to be involved in projects that are beyond the scope of their regular work, and to also help managers and administrators strengthen their understanding of what's going on in their agency, and then to be actively working around succession planning. When you hear folks who've been involved in this mentoring program, both the mentors and the mentees, talk, you just get a really high level of excitement, both from the managers and administrators who have a chance to really mentor and help bring someone along and really have a sense they're doing succession planning for their agency, and then for the supervisors who have a real sense that there's a career ladder for them in the agency, that there's the work they're doing now, and then there are opportunities for personal growth as well. Let's see. So I have just given you very few examples of things that were done by the grantees in specific areas. There's a lot more information about what we've done on our websites, and again, feel free to be in contact with us. There are serious workforce challenges facing us. You've heard that from the data Frida gave us, and we all know that in our day-to-day work with folks in the field. The solutions involve recruiting and selecting the best candidates, really bringing people into our system who are the best fit with the work that needs to be done. But we also have to manage our organization so that we can keep them and so that their connection to us is for a career. It's not an easy task that we're facing, but it's one we have to face right now, because as Frida said, the tsunami is coming. And there are effective strategies and some good partnerships that can help us do that.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. Matthew, do you want to start? I think what we could do now is take about 10 minutes for questions. If people have questions of either Kathy or myself before going on to Mary Berg.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to queue up to ask a question, please press the 1 button on your touch-tone keypad. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue for any reason, you may do so by pressing the pound or hash button. Again, if you'd like to queue up to ask a question, please press 1 at this time. Our first question comes from Jason Bone.
Yeah, hello. Is there any actual data of change in the 20 or 22% of retention rates at any of the 8 sites?
Okay, so your question is, has the turnover gone down in the state where we've been doing our project?
Yes.
I can talk about Maine, and maybe, Kathy, you can talk about the
sure.
parts that you've dealt with. The turnover rate in Maine has never been particularly high. It's never been as high on the whole as 20%. And in the last 3 years, it's gone down dramatically. I would love to take credit for this, but in honesty, I don't think that I can. I think that the reduction in the turnover rate has more to do with the economic situation and the environment, that there are fewer job opportunities and people are hanging on to the positions that they have.
Jason, this is Kathy. We worked in 4 different sites in 3 states. And we saw, I don't have all of the numbers right in front of me here, but we saw mixed patterns across the sites. In some sites we saw, especially over the 5 years. So in a couple of sites we saw changes and improvements in how long people were staying and why people were leaving and some of those kinds of things. But we also saw the impact that a change in agency leadership or a major state initiative can have in undoing some of those gains, which really pushed us to really be thinking about both the importance of the design teams and the local implementation and also about the larger policy and administrative supports for the work.
This is Mary O'Brien, too. Let me just say, too, that we're planning to have the third teleconference in this series will be next fall, and it will be after the 5-year grant period is over. The sites are all in their 5th year now of operation under this federal grant program. So we're going to focus in that call on sites that have had a strong, focus on evaluation and try to look at some of the results after the end of the grant period.
Right.
This is Mary O'Brien. Let me just say before we take the next question, too, if there are people who called in before after we started, the handouts that Frida and Catherine both just went through are at the website of the Resource Center for Organizational Improvement. That's www.nrcoi.org. Click on teleconferences and then go to the date. The slides that Mary Berg will be talking about next are also at that site. So I just wanted to give that to people again in case you called in later. www.nrcoi.org. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Okay, again. Matthew, do we have any other questions?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to queue up to ask a question, please press the 1 button on your phone. I'm showing no other questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Mary, would you like to do your presentation?
Sure, I'll get started. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
All right. My name's Mary Berg, and I'm the Child Welfare Director in Jefferson County, Colorado. And when we were first asked by the University of Denver to participate in this project almost 5 years ago, we, like many other public child welfare agencies, were just faced with making sure that day-to-day operations, responding to calls of abuse and neglect, managing our caseloads and our workloads were really enough of a challenge. We actually sat back and contemplated, could we really participate state, and another what we were thinking was a special project or grant. And as we evaluated how important our workforce is to achieving improved outcomes for children and families, we then took a step back and figured that that really needed to be a part of our daily work operations and not a special project. So in a way, we decided that it was something that we couldn't pass up. So Jefferson County is one of the sites that worked with the Western Regional Recruitment and Retention Project in partnership with the University of Denver. And what I wanted to do today was just share some of the process that we went through, our strategies and challenges that we faced when we decided to really seriously engage in recruitment and retention work. The first slide just puts some context to the Jefferson County Department of Human Services. And Colorado is one of the states that is a state-supervised, county-administered child welfare system, which basically means that we have some local flexibility to meet community needs while we're also responding to both county, state, and federal mandates. We have approximately 180 employees in the division. That includes all casework staff as well as some of our support and administrative staff. On any given day, we are providing services to about 1,800 children. We have about 550 children on any given day in out-of-home and kinship placements. We certify about 90 county foster homes, and we finalize about 100 adoptions annually. That's just a little background to Jefferson County. We're along the foothills in Colorado. We neighbor the city and county of Denver, and we're probably about the third largest county in terms of geographic and population in the state of Colorado. So how we got started, I want to emphasize that what we did was not rocket science, that actually it was basic principles, a lot of creativity, a commitment and focus to this work. And it really started, as you know, with many projects. It starts with having commitment from the top leadership. We realized that if we were going to really take a look at some things that needed to change in our organization to be responsive to retention issues, that we needed commitment from leadership in order to make some changes and to have those changes be sustained. As you heard from the New York concept about design teams, we developed what we called a steering committee, and we had representation from all levels of the organization. What was really interesting about this project, as you know, it's hard to get people to want to volunteer, as we said, we thought were extra projects or work groups or initiatives. But the caseworkers, supervisors, our paraprofessional staff were really excited to participate in this because this was really about their jobs and, most importantly, about improving services to kids and families by improvements made through the workforce. So what we did, as you heard, is we participated in an organizational assessment that was rather thorough that involved gathering survey data from a majority of the casework staff. I think we had something like 85% response rate, which was really high, so we knew that people were engaged in telling us about their opinions and experiences in the organization, as well as some focus groups were conducted. And all of that information was compiled, and one of the things that I really stress from an administrator's perspective is really listening to the issues that were identified in the organizational assessment and accepting the reality of those. What we learned from our organizational assessment was that many of the caseworkers felt that they worked in an environment that was heavily focused on compliance, rules and regulations, probably not unsimilar to many of your organizations, but that through that focus that we really had developed an organizational culture based on fear. Fear of making mistakes, fear of child injury or even fatality, fear for losing your job, fear for getting on that list of things that needed to get done and you weren't doing them. And some of the things that I heard, I didn't necessarily agree with. And it could have been easy for me in my position to say, well, because I don't agree with them, or I don't really think that's true, or this is really hard to hear, that I didn't want to accept them for reality. And so it was important to really listen to the feedback that we heard as a starting point. And then we looked at that and we really decided that, boy, we could focus on one strategy or one certain issue around how do we pick the best worker, but really our organization and our culture was what we needed to tackle first. And as you heard earlier as well, that the supervisory level group was really key. That was something that we did. We really focused on our leadership group, our supervisors who train caseworkers. They model practice. They really set the tone for implementation. They will be your best change agents or your worst change agents. And so really focusing on what was the style of leadership as an organization did we want to embrace to achieve the culture that we wanted. Next, I'm just going to go into a couple of the issues that were identified from the organizational assessment and then just some of the practical solutions that we came up with. One of the things that we heard was that it's really challenging for a caseworker to achieve what we call the work-life balance. Caseworkers are stressed. They bring their worries home at night. They're striving to meet multiple demands. You come in for a day thinking that you know what your schedule is, and it gets tossed out the window in about 15 minutes because there are three children that need to be placed. And they often found themselves working long hours. And we were also concerned about meeting the needs of our clients who didn't function on normal business hours. So one of the things that we took a look at was how can we build some flexibility into the work schedules, but with the idea that the more flexibility we built into work schedules for caseworkers also allowed more flexibility in meeting the needs of clients. So we took on developing a number of alternative work schedules that we called them, as well as instituting and setting up infrastructure and technology assistance for workers to do some teleworking from their home. Some of those things included we developed a condensed work week, and we allowed caseworkers to work for 10-hour days. What it did is it scheduled workers to work longer hours to be able to actually schedule a home visit at 7 o'clock at night that would be considered a part of their normal working day. Instead of before, we said basically we'll go see that client anyhow, and we expected them to make adjustments in their home and their work life to meet those needs. I will have to tell you that I was not someone who is necessarily in favor of making some of those changes because some of those things we had never done before. And sometimes it's easier just to say no than to figure out all of the mechanics involved into making something different. So one of the things I personally have learned is that I never say no initially to an idea, but I really let people develop that idea, present some of the pros and cons to that idea, and really take a look at will those ideas produce better outcomes for kids and families. But sometimes it's just easier to do the things that we do, even if we know that we're getting okay results. We could get better results if we change them. The other thing that we learned was that when we have a vacant position, we mapped it out, and it takes something like 45 days between a time when a caseworker gives the notice and provides a normal two-week notice for a resignation to the time we actually get the next caseworker who has little experience and limited to no training to start. And that is a huge amount of time in a case when we looked at the data around achieving permanency, that we needed to come up with some solutions to filling those gaps, as well as to what happened with the workload distribution. We heard high workload, high caseload from the caseworkers in our organizational assessment. So what we did is we took a look at our Department of Human Services as a whole, which has a couple other divisions in addition to child welfare, our TANF, our workforce, Head Start, and we're an organization that's comprised of about 550 positions. And what we learned through taking a look at the bigger picture was that at any given time, we probably have, 50 positions vacant department-wide. So we developed what we call the pre-vacancy or fill-ahead position, is that as long as we were working within the confines of our governmental structure and our number of FTEs, that we looked at hiring workers prior to having a vacancy based on having vacancies department-wide. So we strategized around this so that we were working within our structure and our FTE caps, but that we were able to bring some staff on ahead of time. We also were then able to match employees if we had a retirement and we knew we were getting a 30-day notice or somebody was moving out of state. Instead of waiting for that person to leave, we brought that person on ahead of time, and then we paired those people together so that we would minimize some of the workload distribution to the staff that we were retaining, which then led to increased burnout. So that was one strategy we employed. I talked a little bit about listening to the reality of our organizational culture. And one of the things that we learned, like I said, was that we had a culture that focused heavily on compliance, rules and regulations. We all have the Child and Family Services review. We all have mandates and timeframes that we need to meet. And so often we created lists and reports from our database system about things that we weren't doing. And then we disseminated those lists, and people, supervisors, followed up and check things off the list and work with caseworkers. And we were very compliance-focused, trying to complete the things on our list. People also learned that they didn't want their name to be on the list and that it created a lot of anxiety if a caseworker saw their name on a list and 100 things that needed to be attended to on their caseload. So we really took a look at focusing on best practice and focusing on delivery of services and outcomes to children and families as opposed to compliance. And it was really a philosophical shift as well as some practical changes in how we administered things. And that my personal philosophy is that if we focus on best practice, we will achieve compliance. And if we focus on compliance, we will meet minimal expectations, but most likely never achieve best practice. So that's something that we have embraced in terms of taking a look at our organizational culture. And through that, we did some improved training, organizational development, leadership training to really look at how we were going to focus on best practice. We also now send out lists of our employees who've achieved great things on their caseload, compliments that they've received. We send out different lists now, and so it's not so concerning for a caseworker's name to show up on a list. So we've really had to change how we practice and the message that we send. The next slide goes into a couple more things. We realize that when workers walk in the door, they weren't prepared to face some of the challenges or just some of the things that we see. And so we took a look at our basic training or on-the-job training, and we really worked to develop a standard curriculum that included evaluation, feedback from supervisors and caseworkers, and we really enhanced some of our upfront training to caseworkers. And it's some of the best training that we have now in comparison to prior, to before we were working with this grant. How many of you have heard that your staff don't feel appreciated by the work that we do? Oftentimes I say, it's not a common experience in child welfare for us to get a call and say, thank you very much. I was using drugs, neglecting my children. You removed them from my home, provided me with services, and now we're reunified. I really appreciate the time that you took to do that. That's not a call that I receive probably very often. And so staff really felt unappreciated for the work that they did. So one of the things that the steering committee developed in conjunction with the staff is a real specific rewards and recognition plan. So we really focused on outlining a number of strategies to recognize staff. And many of those things came from the staff themselves. And so we needed to make that a part of what we did on an ongoing basis. And so we have a time that we acknowledge staff at the end of our quarterly meetings. We have awards that staff can give each other. And so we really try to highlight and share the accomplishments of our staff. Another common thing was that staff reported they didn't feel like they had enough communication, and that communication throughout all levels of the organization was fragmented, and that it was challenging. So another strategy that we implemented is we really focused on how can we communicate at all levels of the organization, who's responsible for communication and how you gather some information, whether you're the receiver or sender of communication. And so the staff really were engaged in the process, and so they really implemented the ideas that they came up with. Some of those included just how staff meetings were organized, how resources were distributed, and how we shared information. Some of the ongoing challenges that we're still facing 5 years into this project is ongoing communication and follow-through. I think one of the things that's extremely important is that you, when you commit to doing something, that you follow through and do it, and that you be realistic about the things that you commit to. So what we learned throughout this project was that we focused on a few areas initially, and then what we learned when we did our follow-up organizational assessment was that the areas that we actually focused on, we made progress according to the staff and how they responded to the questions 3 years later. The areas that we didn't focus so much on, we didn't see a whole lot of change. So I think it's just important to know that you're not going to be able to do everything at once, but that you follow through on the things that you commit to, and that feeds into trust and organizational culture change. We also wanted to make sure that staff were aware of the things that we did over time and that we connected it to recruitment and retention work, so that when we were looking at increasing and changing technology, that it related to workload and making improvements with workload, and that that was something that we were attending to based on what we had heard from caseworkers. And then we all are aware of this, is that we had to live within our own fiscal and budgetary constraints. And so sometimes we needed to be more creative with non-financial rewards or improvements than at other times. And then how are we going to keep this going? A couple of the things that we did is just that we instituted and wrote down our procedures and our policies so that in 3 or 5 years when we want to continue with our flexible schedules and things that we've administered and people turn over and change, that we have those things written down, that we really wanted to focus on were we increasing retention so that our institutional knowledge around child welfare continued. One of the ways we did that is we did actually develop some part-time positions in our organization. We had never done that before. We said cost was prohibitive, as well as challenges to supervision and other things. Well, we have been able to retain some staff over the past 5 years for just instituting, I would say, 10 part-time positions in our organization. One of the significant things, speaking to the question that was raised earlier around were retention rates really impacted or not, and how those retention or turnover rates are influenced by other things, leadership changes, which we had in Jefferson County, state initiatives, and that's very true. One of the things that we've seen significant growth and improvement on over time and over the period of this grant really is on our practice and on our outcomes related to the Child and Family Services Review, because our focus has really been on best practice. And then I think the other thing that we were looking at is that, as you know, on a 5-year grant, it's really hard to have one or two people or three people just steering the ship. So we really reached out to a number of people. We had rotating people on our steering committee. We re-evaluated getting more people involved. And so we figured the more people we had involved in recruitment and retention work, the easier it would be able to sustain in the future. And that concludes my part of the presentation.
Great, Mary. Wonderful practical ideas there. I really appreciate that. Thank you. Matthew, do you want to do a call for more questions?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to queue up to ask a question, please press the 1 button on your touch-tone keypad. Our first question comes from Jerry Michael. Ms. Michael, go ahead. Your line is open. Okay, we will move on. Again, if you'd like to queue up to ask a question, please press the 1 button. We'll hear now from Camilla Foster.
Hi, yes, this is Julian Wagner speaking for Camilla Foster. I had a question in regards to, is there any information out there in regards to grants or additional funding that an organization could receive for some of the type of initiatives that you were speaking of earlier, like a website or somewhere we could go to find additional funding?
Well, I'm this.
Do you want to go ahead, Kathy?
Well, sure. The only thing that I'm aware of right now is that there are there's a Children's Bureau announcement out for workforce grants that are somewhat similar to these recruitment and retention grants. They're only giving 4 nationwide, and they go to a university agency partnership. But if you go to the Children's Bureau website, you can find these workforce initiative grants. Those are going to be pretty competitive, obviously. They're 4 of them nationwide. So that's the only thing I know of. There's not a place. Wouldn't it be great if a foundation would take this on just for, I don't know, incentive support for some of this work? But I'm not aware of anything other than the current announcements.
Thank you.
Right, and this is Mary O'Brien from Organizational Improvement. I would just point out as well, though, that the federal government has invested in a few things. I mean, I work with one of the network of the Children's Bureau Training and Technical Assistance Network National Resource Centers, and we're funded by the federal government to provide free training and technical assistance to state and county and tribal child welfare agencies. So if you're with a public agency, you can connect to that resource center network, and we do have available through that some resources of consultants who can come and work with you on organizational improvement issues. So we've worked a lot with agencies around improving their supervision and dealing with other issues like that related to organizational culture and things that could impact positively on recruitment and retention issues. So you should keep that in mind. And then Kathy mentioned as well, because these grant projects were all federally funded, they are making the resources that they've developed available for free as well. So there are some free resources like that that you can access.
Thank you.
Good point. Okay, Matthew, do we have more questions?
Yes, I'm showing Jerry Michael again.
Can you just speak up?
Jerry, your line is open. You may need to check your mute button if you have a mute button.
Thank you. I'm wondering if it's going to be possible if this webinar is recorded. I don't think I'm the right person in my agency to be sitting here listening to this, although it's incredibly informative.
Yeah.
And
did you say if it could be recorded?
Has it been?
Yes. This is Mary O'Brien from Organizational Improvement. I was going to say that at the end. Yes, these sessions are all recorded, and then the audio file from the call will be posted on our website, by tomorrow, really. So you should be able to go there and just click on that. Anybody can, and listen to a playback session of this call. That will, again, be on our website, the www.nrcoi.org. So, yeah, thank you. That's great. It would be great to pass the information on to anybody else in your agencies who could benefit from it.
Thank you very much.
This is Kathy Potter again. The last slide that Mary Berg has on her agency perspective PowerPoint lists the dates, August 5th and 6th, for a conference that the recruitment and retention site in Denver is holding. It's called Scaling the Summit, Effective Strategies for Recruitment and Retention. If you go to the Butler Institute website, which is listed on the handout, you can click right on information for that. And that's a national conference that's going to bring together grantees and other people who are working in the workforce arena to really do some practical hands-on presentation of strategies. So we have several states that are sending teams. If you have someone in your state or a group in your state that would be particularly interested, we'd love to have you.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a wonderful event, Kathy. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to it.
Hey, Matthew, do we have other questions?
Again, if you'd like to queue up to ask a question, please press the 1 button. I'm showing no other questions at this time. Oh, pardon me. We do have one from Camilla Foster.
Yeah, last question. Since this has been an issue that's been cited with child welfare, as far as the reduction of the number of staff that you guys foresee in the future, is there any national initiatives going on in regards to promoting social work or social services as a career?
Mm-hmm.
With that around the country, and also along with that, will there be any initiatives to increase the salaries for case managers and social work in general?
Both good questions. Kathy, do you want to respond to that?
There are a couple of big national groups that are working on workforce issues and doing quite a bit of federal lobbying around various things. NASW has a big push on social work as a career. The Children's Defense Fund, NAPQA, some other folks have really spent quite a bit of time on workforce issues and are doing some lobbying around specific things like loan forgiveness programs to be extended to child welfare workers, things like that. So there is much more a national dialogue about this in Washington than there has been in the past. And I think in individual states, it really depends a little bit on your political situation. But we've seen in our state in Colorado, primarily related to the news breaking the fact that we had an increase in child fatalities statewide, really seeing a community focus on the child welfare issues and workforce things like the fact that our caseloads have gone up and our number of workers haven't over the last 10 years, really being reported and discussed in our legislature as well. So I think it's a time where there's some potential for things to happen.
Yeah, I agree with that, Kathy. I think that, in the years that I've been working on this, this is a really good time in a way because so much attention is being paid to these issues. So there are resources available for people to use to do the lobbying in their own state and in their own local area. And one of the things is, as you said earlier, the Children's Bureau funding. They are going to be funding a National Workforce Institute. So there will be that available, and that will be providing free training to mid-managers and supervisors, and that's going to be starting in October this year. So, again, there are many resources out there now, and that's a very hopeful sign.
This is Mary O'Brien. Frida and I, when we planned this series, we were hoping to encourage people on the line to share any other experiences that you might have in terms of what you've done in your own sites in terms of recruitment and retention. We know that there's a lot of innovative work going on in the country, around the country, outside of even these recruitment and retention grants. So if, you know, there's anybody on the line who's done anything with, like, I think some of the area around training, leadership training within your agency for managers or supervisors that has a component focusing on recruitment and retention. I know, for instance, there's some folks from Pennsylvania who had registered, and I know you have a strong leadership institute, and I don't know if that has a component about recruitment and retention, or any other strategies that folks are using to, you know, improve the organizational culture, the kinds of things Mary talked about, like giving a positive message and feedback to your staff, recognition of staff, focusing on best practice, that kind of thing, or the project that Catherine mentioned about mentoring in Connecticut and how they've used, you know, senior staff to mentor incoming staff. You know, if there's any initiatives like that, I would encourage you to, you know, to press one on your button and share them with us. And while you're thinking about that, let me just mention, too, I would just ask a follow-up question to Mary Berg. Mary, can you just tell us a little bit about what you've seen in terms of impact for the work that you've done? You mentioned doing that survey again after 3 years of your staff, and you also mentioned the positive impact on CFSR outcomes. And I don't know if you could tell us anything about what you've seen from those, either qualitatively or sort of quantitatively in terms of impact of your work.
Well, initially, like I said, what we had heard really loud and clear was this culture of fear that we had, fear of making mistakes, fear of, you know, losing their job because of performance or child injury, some of those things. We also had a concern about just, you know, the process working with the court system for our clients sometimes naturally produces an adversarial type of role or partnership. And so we really focused on improving our relationship with our courts and with our attorneys, and opening up some dialogue and improving our partnerships, as well as working on the type of culture and organization and messages we were sending to staff. And in the three-year follow-up organizational assessment, we did not hear staff identify with the statements around a fear-based culture. So we really figured that the things that we did to focus on those around rewards and recognition, communication, really taking a look and listening to, I think, what the caseworkers said about our environment, really helped to minimize and start shifting our culture. And I won't say that, oh, it was like a magic wand and now everything is great. No, it's constant attention. It's constant reevaluation. It's constantly focusing on what is our mission and trying to achieve our mission around child protection and, you know, family self-sufficiency instead of just looking at, are we doing what we're supposed to be doing? And are we meeting, you know, are we following the rules and regulations? Did we do what we were supposed to do? And then secondly, you talked about the Child and Family Services Review. And I'll give an example. One of the things that we talked about was how imperative it is to make sure that you're making your monthly contacts with your children as a minimum, making those monthly contacts. And so we initially went about doing that by saying, you know, from an administrative perspective, I would hear things like, gosh, it snowed at the end of the month, and I had to move 3 kids this month, and I was out sick. I missed seeing 2 kids on my caseload. And we would talk about that as supervisors group. Those were plausible reasons why things happened. And from an administrative perspective, when we started saying from a child's perspective, if I was one of those 2 kids who didn't get to see my caseworker or someone didn't come out to the home to check on me, I wouldn't know why. From a parent's perspective,
I don't want to be the parent of the child who doesn't get seen. And it really did not make sense for us once we started to take a look at things from a practice or a child and family-focused perspective. Any of the lists that we took a look at before with numbers and percentages of caseworkers meeting their contacts were not as impactful as viewing those things from a child's perspective. And I would say later that I'm really proud as a result for 2007, Jefferson County is the leading county for our face-to-face contacts in the state of Colorado for both children in out-of-home placement as well as in children who remain in their home. Our out-of-home placement is like 99.2% for the entire year. Our in-home cases is about 96.8%. And those are exceeding what the federal benchmarks will be. And it was really about kind of just how I described as an example about our shift in our culture mm-hmm. and in our focus and in our practice.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank
it helps
you.
Brag about the things that you do. And all the staff know that, too. We have that list going out. We are sending that message out. We're supporting our staff in making that happen, especially in light of the attention that Colorado has had around child fatalities.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Matthew, do you have any other people queued up for questions?
No, I'm showing no others in queue right now.
So it's possible we're the only ones who are still here.
Well, Frida, maybe we should wrap it up. Do you want me to do that
sure.
at this point? Okay, great. Well, listen, thank you to everyone for participating in the call today. Thank you to Frida Bernatovich and Catherine Potter and Mary Burke for your presentations and to everyone on the line for coming. We asked people who participated to fill in and submit an online evaluation form. The link that for that was in the email that you got with the phone number for this call, and you should have another email today with the same link. We appreciate if you could use that and give us your feedback because we use it to improve our teleconference offerings. We want to make sure to invite everyone, too, to attend the second session in this series, which will be Tuesday, May 20th, More Promising Strategies, Recruitment and Retention, which, and will feature three of the grantee sites talking more about what they've done and learned. You can register for that on our website, www.nrcoi.org, if you haven't done that already. And as I mentioned earlier, the playback option for this session will also be available on that website. Soon. So again, thank you everyone for coming. We hope to hear from you again soon.
Thank you, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.